So I think we've covered the Sri Aurobindo's theory of quantitative meter, metrics, pretty well by now. The first M of my presentation, metrics, meaning, and music. So we're moving towards meaning, and the last couple of sessions we have begun to focus a bit on the meaning that Sri Aurobindo wants to convey through his poetry. His meanings are unique. Like his metrics, this is number six, right? Could you give her a copy of 4 and 5? Because she wants to understand something about the metrics.
I tried to find out which we are using, but I couldn't.
And rhythm, especially.
Yes.
So, if you can look at or listen to 4 and 5, lecture 4 and lecture 5, you'll get a lot. I just saw one of them, 3, I think. And it had a lot of information in it that you could use. So maybe 3, 4, and 5. But I have 3. I can give her 3.
If no problem. You can copy it.
You can give 4 and 5. So just those 3 would give you a lot of information that you can use.
What's the quantitative?
Everything is from that book, but it's not necessary to read the book. It's better to just hear the summaries that I've given. Because I've brought out enough of the basic principles that you don't need to read the whole chapter on quantitative meter. In fact, there's a lot there that you don't really require, but it's interesting. So now we're moving away from that, and we're moving into meaning, which is why I'm mentioning that she might want to see 3, 4, and 5, or hear 3, 4, and 5, because we're not going to deal that much more with metrics, with rhythm.
Can you enlarge it a little bit?
Yes. I'm only looking at the last paragraph. And because it's PDF, I can't take it out and highlight it and so on. So, as we move towards the topic of meaning, which we started a bit last time, because there are a number of you who are not native English speakers, I will also look tonight at a number of examples that Sri Aurobindo gives from English poetry, because you probably are not generally familiar with the history of English poetry. And so I'm going to take a little time to come down from Sri Aurobindo's plane of metrics and meaning and look a little bit closely at some English poetry which he uses as an example, not only of his metrics, but also of what he's trying to accomplish. The mantric idea of poetry he finds examples of in English poetry. So last time we discussed a little bit and read a little bit about the principle of lyrical poetry as the origin of expression, musical expression, which comes from within. And that's the origin of poetry. Then he speaks a bit about drama and about the epic as further developments of the poetic spirit. This chapter is called Form and Spirit, Poetic Form and Poetic Spirit. And so just in order for us to raise our standard of thinking a little bit with respect to lyrics, dramatic poetry, and epic poetry, I thought I would just briefly look at a couple of paragraphs before going into a closer examination of some English forms. The next chapter is called Word and Spirit, and that's the one that we'll be going into. So I think that these two chapters, Form and Spirit and Word and Spirit, are really very nice, compact expressions and explanations of the essential idea behind the mantric expression of intuitive mind through poetry. So Sri Aurobindo writes here, "The soul of man, a many-motioned representative of the world spirit, subsisting and seeking for itself and its own meanings, subsisting and seeking for itself and its own meanings amid the laws and powers and moving forces of the universe." And discovering and realizing its spiritual relations with others will be the vision and intention of a dramatic poetry fully reflective of the now growing intuitive mind of the future. The spirit and intention of the narrative and epic forms of poetry must undergo the same transmuting change. Hitherto, the poetical narrative has been a simple relation or a vivid picturing or transcript of life and action, varied by description of surrounding circumstance and indication of mood and feeling and character, or else that with the development of an idea or a mental and moral significance at the basis, with the story as its occasion or form of its presentation. The idea of epic poetry in the past, largely storytelling. The change to a profounder motive will substitute a soul significance as the real substance. The action will not be there for its external surface interest, but as a vital indication of the significance. The surrounding circumstance will be only such as helps to point and frame it and bring out its accessory suggestions and mood and feeling and character, its internal powers and phases. Circumstance becomes an expression of the mood of the inner feeling, meaning, truth. And so the whole thing is transmuted into a symbol. The new epic form. An intensive narrative, intensive in simplicity or in richness of significant shades, tones, and colors, will be the more profound and subtle art of this kind in the future, and its appropriate structures determined by the needs of this inner art motive. A first form of the intensive and spiritually significant poetic narrative has already been created. And attempts to replace the more superficially intellectual motives, where the idea rather supervened upon the story, or read into it the sense of its turns or its total movement. But here the story tends more to be the living expression of the idea, and the idea itself, vibrant in the speech and description and action, the index of a profounder soul motive. The future poetry will follow this direction with a more and more subtle and variable inwardness and a greater fusion and living identity of soul motive, indicative idea, suggestive description, and immensely significant speech and action. Just think for a moment back to Talthybius arriving at the gates of Priam and shouting for Deiphobus to wake up from his dream, carrying in his helpless hands the doom of an empire. Every action and every word conveys the inner idea of impending doom against which nothing can stand. So we read these lines from Ilion a couple of weeks back. I think that when Sri Aurobindo says that a a form of the future epic poetry is already being developed. He is referring, at least to some extent, to his own work. And he's also referring to other modern poets. And he's looking forward to Ilion and Savitri. But he's writing this around 1922. He did go back and revise it in 1950. But I think that this appears to me to be written from the point of view of 1922, and I'll show you why a little bit later. The same governing vision will be there as in lyric and drama. The same governing vision. The method of development will alone be different according to the necessities of the more diffused, circumstanced, and outwardly processive form which is proper to narrative. So he didn't give up the importance of the music and the importance of the power and the transmission and the intuitive origin in writing the epic. He didn't sacrifice those things to the story. He simply adds the dimension of story to that inspiration. So in the next chapter, on page 289, I just want to read a sentence from this page. More or less. The words which we use in our speech seem to be, if we look only at their external formation, mere physical sounds, which a device of the mind has made to represent certain objects and ideas and perceptions. A machinery nervous perhaps in origin, but developed for a constantly finer and more intricate use by the growing intelligence. But if we look at them in their inmost psychological and not solely at their more external aspect, we shall see that what constitutes speech and gives it its life and appeal and significance is a subtle conscious force which informs and is the soul of the body of sound. It is a superconscient nature force, raising its material out of our subconscious, but growingly conscious in its operations in the human mind that develops itself in one fundamental way, and yet variously in language. It is this force, this Shakti, to which the old Vedic thinkers gave the name of Vak. The goddess of creative speech. I'm going to skip over this a little bit and go to this sentence. The degree of word force characteristic of prose speech avails ordinarily to distinguish and state things to the conceptual intelligence. The word of the poet sees and presents in its body and image to a subtle visual perception in the mind, awakened by an inner rhythmic audition, truth of soul and thought experience, and truth of sense and life. The spiritual and living actuality of idea and object. This is a direct transmission of the meaning through the sound of the word. Doesn't need to appeal to the conceptual intellect. I want to skip to the next paragraph. This is the main one to start our exploration. This seeing speech has itself, however, different grades of its power of vision and expression of vision, different grades, different levels. The first and simplest power is limited to a clear poetic adequacy. An example from Dryden. Whate'er he did was done with so much ease, in him alone 'twas natural to please. Very simple, adequate poetic speech to express a human quality. I think we don't have any doubt about what he means. And then another from Wordsworth, I think I'll skip that one. And I want to go then to the second power, the second power tries to go beyond this fine and perfect adequacy in its intensities, attempts a more rich or a more powerful expression. Not merely sound, not merely sound and adequate to poetic vision, but dynamic and strongly effective. And so he gives an example from Pope, Alexander Pope. Atoms and systems into ruins hurled, and now a bubble burst, and now a world. And a better one from Milton. Hurled headlong, flaming from the ethereal sky, with hideous ruin and combustion, down to bottomless perdition. Hurled headlong, flaming from the ethereal sky, with hideous ruin and combustion, down to bottomless perdition.
Paradise Lost.
So, this is more forceful. And then the third power, a richer, subtler, and usually a truer poetic effectivity is attained not by this rhetorical manner, but through a language succeeding by apt and vivid metaphor and simile, richness and beauty of phrase, or the forceful word that makes the mind see the body of the thought with a singularly living distinctness or energy of suggestion and nearness. And I want to skip to Shelley's example. When hearts have once mingled, love first leaves the well-built nest. The weak one is singled to endure what it once possessed. The next one, its passions will rock thee as the storms rock the ravens on high. Bright reason will mock thee like the sun from a wintry sky. Sri Aurobindo says, in this manner, English poetry is especially opulent and gets from it much of its energy and power. It gets much of its energy and power from its opulence. There are many words, many phrases that can be combined in infinite ways to express subtleties. And there is where it gets its power. But yet, we feel that this is not the highest degree of which poetic speech is capable. We. I suppose he means I. There is a more intimate vision, a more penetrating spiritual emotion, a more intense and revealing speech, to which the soul can be more vibrantly sensible. This comes to its first self-discovery when either the adequate or the dynamically effective style is raised into a greater illumination in which the inner mind sees and feels object, emotion, idea, not only clearly or richly or distinctly and powerfully, but in a flash or outbreak of transforming light, which kindles the thought or image into a disclosure of new significances, of a much more inner character, a more profoundly revealing vision, emotion, spiritual response. As in Dryden's, "And paradise was opened in his face." Not very beautiful, but striking. Shelley's. "The heart's echoes render no song when the spirit is mute. No song but sad dirges like the wind through a ruined cell." What do you see, Sandy?
I see a monastery on a hill that's not occupied anymore, and the wind blowing through it. It's perhaps fall.
Empty.
Yes.
Desolate. Good.
Desolation.
There's another from Shelley here. "And now, alas, the poor sprite is imprisoned for some fault of his in a body like a grave." And then he has one from Wordsworth, which is very, from Shelley and Wordsworth. "The silent moon in her interlunar swoon." It's a mood, just a mood. "The silent moon in her interlunar swoon." What? Kitty?
The new moon, you know?
Between the two.
No, he's not speaking about a thing. He's expressing a mood only.
But the mood comes from.
It's a lunar swoon must convey a kind of emptiness and sadness. And Wordsworth's, "They flash upon the inner eye, which is the bliss of solitude."
Daffodils.
Flowers laugh before thee in their beds, and fragrance in thy footing treads. Thou dost preserve the stars from wrong, and the most ancient heavens through thee are fresh and strong. I just wanted to look at this paragraph. The genius of the poet can do work of a high beauty or of a considerable greatness in any of these degrees of poetic speech. But it is the more purely intuitive, inspired or revelatory utterance that is the most rare and difficult for the human mind to command. And it is these kinds that we peculiarly value. Their power not only moves and seizes us the most, but it admits the soul to a most spiritually profound light of seeing and ecstasy of feeling, even of ordinary ideas and objects, and in its highest force to thoughts and things that surpass the manner and range and limits of depth of the normal intelligence. I wanted to read this one as an example, perhaps, of that. Heaven's light forever shines, earth's shadows fly. Life, like a dome of many-colored glass, stains the white radiance of eternity until death tramples it to fragments. Life, like a dome of many-colored glass, stains the white radiance of eternity until death tramples it to fragments. The voice of poetry comes from a region above us, a plane of our being above and beyond our personal intelligence, a supermind which sees things in their innermost and largest truth, by a spiritual identity, and with a lustrous effulgency and rapture. And its native language is a revelatory, inspired, intuitive word, limpid or subtly vibrant or densely packed with the glory of this ecstasy and luster. It is the possession of the mind by the supramental touch and the communicated impulse to seize this sight and word that creates the psychological phenomenon of poetic inspiration. And it is the invasion of it by a superior power to that which it is normally able to harbor that produces the temporary excitement of brain and heart and nerve which accompanies the inrush of the influence. Now, in the 30s, Sri Aurobindo wrote similar things about the inspiration which comes to motivate intuitive speech. But he didn't call it supermind or supramental, he called it overmind. And he said that all poetic inspiration comes from the overmind. So between 1922 and 1932, he came to an understanding of poetic inspiration which was a bit more detailed. But he says the same thing about poetic inspiration. He just puts it in a different range. And he says that poetry has, on the whole, very few touches of that pure overmind inspiration, although all poetic inspiration comes from that plane and gets translated by different levels of mind. And so he says that his aim was to transmit as purely as possible from that direct plane of inspiration. Now I would like to jump forward to on quantitative meter to give a few more examples of from English poetry that he uses. I'm going to jump to page 349. Here he is speaking about, and unconsciously quantitative free verse. And remember, we have learned that it is quantitative meter in English, which he says carries most originally and directly this intuitive inspiration. And unconsciously quantitative free verse may be said to exist already in the writings of Whitman and contemporary modernist poets. In modern free verse, the underlying impulse is to get away from the vexed limitations of accentual meter, its set forms and its traditional poetic language, and to create forms and a diction more kin to the natural rhythm and turns of language which we find in common speech and in prose. In Whitman, the attempt at perfection of rhythm is often present, and when he does his best as a rhythmist, it rises to a high-strung acuteness which gives a great beauty of movement to his finest lines. But what he arrives at is a true quantitative free verse. Come, lovely and soothing death, undulate round the world, serenely arriving, in the day, in the night, to all, to each, sooner or later, delicate death, approach. Strong deliver us, when it is so, when thou hast taken them, I joyously sing the dead. Lost in the loving, floating ocean of thee, laved in the flood of thy bliss, O death, and the sights of the open landscape and the high spread sky are fitting, and life and the fields and the huge and thoughtful night. And the huge and thoughtful night. Lost in the loving, floating ocean of thee, laved in the flood of thy bliss, O death, and the sights of the open landscape and the high spread sky are fitting, and life and the fields and the huge and thoughtful night. Think for a moment back over the lines that we've read this evening and recall that phrase of Sri Aurobindo, who said that one of the qualities of the most highly inspired mantric poetry is grave exaltation. And we discussed briefly how exaltation and grave go together. This profound joy of sadness, this ubiquity and omnipresence of death. And so in Savitri, the theme is death. Savitri is about death. Many of these lines that Sri Aurobindo referred to are about this transition from something which is upheld and made beautiful and glorious and is then trampled to fragments. So here we see a couple of things. We see the form, something about the form and something about the spirit of inspired and intuitive poetry, which carries home to us profound truths of existence. Sri Aurobindo says that is comparatively rare in its high beauty, but everywhere the rhythmic trend is the same wherever we look at it, as in the rhymed freedom of this opening. And he's referring to Whitman. Weapon, shapely, naked, wan. Head from the mother's bowels drawn. Wooded flesh and metal bone. Limb only one and lip only one. Gray-blue leaf by red heat grown. Held produced from a little seed sown. Resting the grass amid and upon, to be leaned and to lean on. What's he talking about? Pardon? Limb only one and lip only one, gray blue leaf by red heat grown. Held produced from a little seed sown, resting the grass amid and upon, to be leaned and to lean on. Helve.
Helve produce.
What is it mean? Death.
Death. They
cut a tree down.
To cut, yeah.
And it's laying in the grass.
Maybe a spear. Maybe a sword. The head is drawn from the steel. It has one limb, the handle. It has one lip, the blade.
Maybe it's an axe.
Maybe it's an axe. Anyway, you rest it in the grass and you can lean on it.
I think it's an axe.
An axe. It's a weapon. Don't forget. First line.
Weapon shapely, naked, long.
Weapon. Oops, went to the wrong place. So I would like, I have 15 minutes, if that's okay with you. I'll take another 15 minutes. And I would like to read to you some lines from Shelley that we are told in history, in the archives, from the archives, we're told that this is a poem that Sri Aurobindo read often as a young man. And it's a poem that I also have read often, and I find in it the source of much of Sri Aurobindo's early poetry. And it exemplifies many of the principles that we've been hearing about, and it also uses the same basic rhythmic structure as Savitri. And it's called The Revolt of Islam. And it's about the French Revolution. Shelley wrote this around 1800. But it's about the spirit of the French Revolution. This is a kind of new epic form. I think it's a seed of that new epic form. It's a very long poem. It's got 12 cantos. It's about 100 pages long. So it definitely falls into, shall I close that? Do you want to turn that off, or shall I sleep this one? When the last hope of trampled France had failed, like a brief dream of unremaining glory, from visions of despair I rose and scaled the peak of an aerial promontory, whose caverned base with the vexed surge was hoary, and saw the golden dawn break forth and waken each cloud and every wave. But transitory the calm, for sudden the firm earth was shaken, as if by the last wreck its frame were overtaken. So as I stood, one blast of muttering thunder burst in far peals along the waveless deep, when, gathering fast, around, above, and under, long trains of tremulous mist began to creep, until their complicating lines did steep the orient sun in shadow. Not a sound was heard. One horrible repose did keep the forests and the floods and all around darkness more dread than night was poured upon the ground. Hark! 'Tis the rushing of a wind that sweeps earth and the ocean. See! The lightnings yawn, deluging heaven with fire, and the lashed deeps glitter and boil beneath. It rages on, one mighty stream, whirlwind and waves upthrown, lightning and hail and darkness eddying by. There is a pause. The sea birds that were gone into their caves to shriek come forth to spy what calm has fallen on earth, what light is in the sky. For where the irresistible irresistible storm had cloven that fearful darkness, the blue sky was seen, fretted with many a fair cloud interwoven most delicately, and the ocean green, beneath that opening spot of blue, serene, quivered like burning emerald. Calm was spread on all below. But far on high, between earth and the upper air, the vast clouds fled, countless and swift, as leaves on autumn's tempest shed. Forever. As the war became more fierce between the whirlwinds and the rack on high, that spot grew more serene. Blue light did pierce the woof of those white clouds, which seemed to lie far, deep, and motionless, while through the sky the pallid semicircle of the moon passed on in slow and moving majesty. Its upper horn arrayed in mists, which soon but slowly fled, like dew beneath the beams of noon. I could not choose but gaze. A fascination dwelt in that moon and sky and clouds, which drew my fancy thither, and in expectation of what I knew not, I remained. The hue of the white moon, amid that heaven so blue, suddenly stained with shadow, did appear, a speck, a cloud, a shape, approaching grew like a great ship in the sun's sinking sphere, beheld afar at sea, and swift it came anear, even like a bark, which from a chasm of mountains dark, vast, and overhanging on a river which there collects the strength of all the fountains, comes forth whilst with the speed its frame doth quiver, sails, oars, and stream tending to one endeavor. So from that chasm of light, a winged form on all the winds of heaven approaching, ever floated, dilating as it came. The storm pursued it with fierce blasts and lightnings swift and warm, a course precipitous of dizzy speed, suspending thought and breath, a monstrous sight, for in the air do I behold, indeed, an eagle and a serpent wreathed in fight, and now relaxing its impetuous flight, before the aerial rock on which I stood, the eagle, hovering, wheeled to left and right, and hung with lingering wings over the flood, and startled with its yells the wide air's solitude. A shaft of light upon its wings descended, and every golden feather gleamed therein, feather and scale inextricably blended. The serpent's mailed and many-colored skin shone through the plumes, Its coils were twined within by many a swollen and knotted fold, and high and far the neck, receding, lithe and thin, sustained a crested head, which warily shifted and glanced before the eagle's steadfast eye. Around, around, in ceaseless circles wheeling, with clang of wings and scream, the eagle sailed incessantly, sometimes on high concealing its lessening orbs, sometimes as if it failed, drooped through the air, and still it shrieked and wailed, and talon intermittently assailed the wreathed serpent who did ever seek upon his enemy's heart a mortal wound to wreak. What life, what power was kindled and arose within the sphere of that appalling fray? For from the encounter of those wondrous foes, a vapor like the sea's suspended spray hung, gathered. In the void air, far away, floated the shattered plumes. Bright scales did leap where'er the eagle's talons made their way, like sparks into the darkness. As they sweep, blood stains the snowy foam of the tumultuous deep. Swift chances in that combat, many a check and many a change, a dark and wild turmoil. Sometimes the snake around his enemy's neck locked in stiff rings his adamantine coil, until the eagle, faint with pain and toil, remitted his strong flight, and near the sea languidly fluttered, hopeless so to foil his adversary, who then reared on high his red and burning crest, radiant with victory. Then on the white edge of the bursting surge, where they had sunk together, would the snake relax his suffocating grasp and scourge the wind with his wild writhings, for to break that chain of torment, the vast bird would shake the strength of his unconquerable wings, and in despair, and with his sinewy neck, dissolve in sudden shock, those linked rings. Then soar as swift as smoke from a volcano springs. While, and strength encountered strength, thus long, but unprevailing. The event of that portentous fight appeared at length. Until the lamp of day was almost spent, it had endured, when, lifeless, stark, and rent, hung high that mighty serpent, and at last fell to the sea, while o'er the continent, with clang of wings and scream, the eagle passed, heavily borne away on the exhausted blast. And with it fled the tempest, so that ocean and earth and sky shone through the atmosphere. Only 'twas strange to see the red commotion of waves like mountains o'er the sinking sphere of sunset sweep, and their fierce roar to hear amid the calm. Down the steep path I wound to the seashore. The evening was most clear and beautiful, and there the sea I found, calm as a cradled child in dreamless slumber bound. There was a woman, beautiful as morning, sitting beneath the rocks upon the sand of the waste sea, fair as one flower adorning an icy wilderness. Each delicate hand lay crossed upon her bosom, and the band of her dark hair had fallen, and so she sate looking upon the waves. On the bare strand, upon the sea mark, a small boat did wait, fair as herself, like love by hope left desolate. It seemed that this fair shape had looked upon that unimaginable fight, and now that her sweet eyes were weary of the sun, as brightly it illustrated her woe, for in the tears which silently to flow paused not, its luster hung, she watched, the foam wreaths which the faint tide wove below upon the spangled sands, groaned heavily, and after every groan looked up over the sea. And when she saw the wounded serpent make his path between the waves, her lips grew pale, parted, and quivered. The tears ceased to break from her immovable eyes. No voice of wail escaped her, but she rose, and on the gale, loosening her star-bright robe and shadowy hair, poured forth her voice. The caverns of the veil that opened to the ocean caught it there, and filled with silver sounds the overflowing air. She spake in language whose strange melody might not belong to earth. I heard alone what made its music more melodious be the pity and the love of every tone. But to the snake those accents sweet were known, his native tongue and hers, nor did he beat the hoar spray idly then, but winding on through the green shadows of the waves that meet near to the shore, did pause beside her snowy feet. Then on the sands the woman sate again, and wept, and clasped her hands, and all between renewed the unintelligible strain of her melodious voice and eloquent mien, and she unveiled her bosom, and the green and glancing shadows of the sea did play o'er its marmoreal depth, one moment seen, for ere the next the serpent did obey her voice, and coiled in rest, in her embrace it lay. Then she arose, and smiled on me with eyes serene yet sorrowing. Like that planet fair, while yet the daylight lingereth in the skies, which cleaves with arrowy beams the dark red air, and said, "To grieve is wise." But the despair was weak and vain which led thee here from sleep. This shalt thou know and more if thou dost dare with me and with this serpent o'er the deep, a voyage divine and strange, companionship to keep. Her voice was like the wildest, saddest tone, yet sweet, of some loved voice heard long ago. I wept. Shall this fair woman all alone over the sea with that fierce serpent go? His head is on her heart, and who can know how soon he may devour his feeble prey? Such were my thoughts when the tide began to flow, and that strange boat, like the moon's shade, did away amid reflected stars that in the waters lay. Who is the serpent and who is the snake? And who is she and who is he? So I would like to ask you if you have at home the collected poems to read in this light Khaled of the Sea.
That's the name of it?
A poem of Sri Aurobindo called Khaled of the Sea in Sri Aurobindo's collected poems. It's a short, long poem. It's about 6 or 7 pages long. You can read it in 15 minutes easily.
Khaled.
Khaled of the Sea. It's very beautifully melodious, and it tells a similar story.
And this one was called The Revolt of Islam.
This is The Revolt of Islam.
Who is the serpent, considering what the serpent means in Western religious?
Well, Shelley tells us a few stanzas on two powers over mortal things dominion hold. Two powers o'er mortal things dominion hold, ruling the world with a divided lot. Immortal, all-pervading, manifold, equal gods. The spirit of evil, one power of many shapes. One shape of many names, reigning o'er a world of woe. The spirit of good did creep among the nations of mankind. And every tongue cursed and blasphemed him as he passed. For none knew good from evil. The fiend whose name was Legion, death, decay, earthquake and blight, and want and madness pale, winged and wan. So that's the snake and the eagle are good and evil. Now the question is, which is which?
Eagle, of course, is good.
So.
Serpent, of course, is bad. So it's the image like we have everywhere, even in Bible.
Especially in the Bible.
Yeah, so I was thinking something else, but it's wisdom.
Well, it's Shelley, so that's Western.
Anyway, the wonderful thing about this is that it's an epic, and he fully develops the forces of good and the forces of evil and their interplay, and he develops mastery, and mastery is achieved when he and she rise to the level of super he and super she, Purusha and Prakriti, and unite in the end. So he's the soul and she is the spirit, and in the end they are both personified under a dome of light in the overmind plane and become one.
On the sea, we have a boat.
The time.
Serpent is also energy. So, the wisdom, how Mother says, the symbolism of the biblical snake is actually the wisdom of the mind. I don't know which one.
So you'll notice that the snake was taken into her arms and so there, both in imagery, that is to say meaning, and in sound, sometimes the quality of the sound becomes very mystical and melodic and ethereal, and so Shelley was truly a master of mystical poetry and speech. There's another poem which he wrote just at the same week that he died, called Epipsychidion. This was one of his first poems, Revolt of Islam. Epipsychidion was his last poem.
I didn't realize it was his last poem.
And it is absolutely extraordinarily mystical and beautiful.
What has Islam to do with this? Why is Islam the Lord of Islam? I have Shalit. Okay.
Good. So please read that poem.
I don't
then
know if I have this poem. But I have
So that's all for tonight.